Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's IBM The World Is Not Always Secure. How is your data conference call? Today's call is being recorded. For opening remarks, I'd like to now turn the conference over to Ms. Diane McCollum. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. My name is Diane McCollum, and I am the IBM Worldwide Product Manager for DB2, DB2, and IMS Tools. So welcome to The World Is Not Always Secure. How is your data? I am pleased to introduce to you our two speakers. Our first speaker will be James Catchpole, an IMS Software IT Specialist in Z-Series Software in the Advanced Technical Support Organization. And following James will be Ernest Mansell, a certified DB2 Tools Technical Sales Specialist in the Americas. With that, I'd like to turn it over to James.
Good morning. I'm on slide 2, the agenda, and I'll quickly go through the agenda. The first section is an introduction and why do we want to encrypt data. The second section introduces the concept of cryptography and the concept of keys to make sure that we're all level set, because these feed directly into the products that IBM has. The third section starts to deal with the technical aspects of it, the ZOS Integrated Cryptographic Support Facility, which is an integral part of ZOS and is the main software feature that supports all of the hardware cryptographic features, as well as does the key management. Next would be the IBM Data Encryption for IMS and DB2 Databases tool, which Ernie will talk about. Then the IBM Encryption Facility, which is a set of ZOS software that allows you to encrypt data that's destined to go outside your organization. Last in that section is a new facility we have in DB2 UDB version 8, which are built-in primitive functions that application programmers can use to encrypt specific cells or specific columns within a table. The last section is we're going to go through a flow of both IMS and DB2 encryption and how it works. Following that, we'll have a Z-Series cryptography hardware support. We'll talk a little bit about the various models of the Z-Series and what kind of encryption and what kind of hardware features do what kind of encryption. Then following that is a matrix of what we just talked about before, and then a summary. Okay, so now I'm going to slide 3. Why encrypt your data? Well, one of them is the security headlines you see every day in the paper. More and more people are concerned about their own private information, as well as more and more corporations are concerned about protecting their proprietary information and doing things like making their accounting more robust and things like that. So the security headlines daily are putting a lot of pressure on business and governments to handle and encrypt your data more robustly. Slide 4 talks about some of the regulatory and compliance considerations. I'm not going to list all of these, but both in the United States and in Europe, and some of the international security standards are more and more requiring large corporations to do a better job of protecting their data. Slide 5 talks about what does it cost you, okay, should you not encrypt your data and it get compromised. And in this example, it could cost you a lot of money in terms of brand image, but it could also cost you a lot of money in terms of having to settle claims and things like that should value a customer data be lost and people come back for some sort of remuneration. So the potential cost of a security breach sometimes is not well understood within the structure of a business. And when you sit down and analyze, okay, what would it cost me if this data was compromised? Then you get a better understanding of how much money you're willing to invest, for example, in doing encryption for your data. Slide 6. Here we're going to talk a little bit about the concepts of what cryptography is. In its simplest terms, cryptography scrambles or disguises information. It's as simple as that. The act of cryptography itself is fairly straightforward, and there are quite a few mechanisms available out there that are publicly known to do the cryptography and to disguise your information. But one of the points that a lot of people don't realize is that it can only be available to persons or programs that have the correct information to unscramble the information. And this is where we're going to get into the subject of what do you want to accomplish when you do cryptography. And I think the three basic things for cryptography are identity and authentication. Before somebody can look at the encrypted data, you have to know who they are, and you have to authenticate them. And the third item, non-repudiation, you want to ensure that whoever is encrypting data and sending it, okay, when it gets to where it's going, okay, number one, they can't deny it, but on the other hand, the person who gets it has to be guaranteed that the person who sent it is really that person, okay? So that if I send something to Ernie and he gets it, he has to have a mechanism for knowing that this is exactly what I sent, and it did exactly come from me. Now, in ciphering or encryption, and we use those two terms interchangeably, is converting plain text into ciphertext. And deciphering, or decryption, again we use those terms interchangeably, converts ciphertext back into plain text. It's just as simple as that. Slide 9 deals with, okay, the most practical cryptographic systems, and there's two elements to it. One is a processor algorithm, a set of rules to specify the steps needed to encipher or decipher data. And an example of that might be DES or triple DES. It might be AES, the American Encryption Standard. It might be SHA, which is a hashing algorithm, and there are various versions of that. In any case, these algorithms are generally part of the public domain. They have to be part of the public domain because that's how you ensure the robustness of the algorithms. It's going to be the keys that give it the security. And that brings you to the concept of a cryptographic key. It's a string of numbers or characters used to select the algorithms for encrypting or decrypting plain text and ciphertext. And you will see that our products, both software and hardware, support a wide variety of different process algorithms and a wide variety of different key structures. Okay, for example, in our latest processor, we support AES with a 128-bit key, and we support SHA up to a 256-bit key. And these things become important in terms of how secure your data is. The larger the key, the more difficult it would be for somebody to crack it and get into the data. Okay, so the two important things are, what are the processes or algorithms you're going to choose, and the second thing is the cryptographic key you're going to use. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more later about the notion of key management. The most important thing that you'll do when you implement cryptography is set up an adequate key management system. This is the thing that is the most difficult within cryptography, is making sure that your keys are secure, but not only that, that down the road, 4, 5, 6 years from now, if you have to bring data back in for some reason, that you can actually locate the correct key to decipher that data after years have gone by. Slide 10. So cryptographic keys are used for encrypting and decrypting plain text and ciphertext, and cryptographic keys are used for encrypting and decrypting files, databases, logs, image copies, backups, and network transmissions. And you'll see that we have a variety of different tools to encrypt all of these types of things. Slide 11. There's a notion of a secret key, and the next slide will be a secure key. Okay? Now, what is a secret key? A secret key is known only to one, or at most, two parties who want to communicate with each other person to person, program to program, or person to program. And in doing so, they exchange the data in an encrypted format. And only these two parties have access to these secret keys. Now, in the case of IMS, the parties would be two programs. Somebody will insert some IMS data, and using a key, it will get encrypted. Now, another person comes along and enters a different transaction wanting to access that data. That program also has to have access to the same secret key. So in that case, even though it's a database system, the two parties communicating with each other are the program, one program for one user, another program for a second user, and the database is just the intermediary place where you store the encrypted data. Now, the IBM IMS DB2 data encryption tool uses secret keys. Public keys, on the other hand, are keys that are registered at some repository that anybody can access. And this is normally used on the Internet to negotiate between a person who wants to go to Amazon.com or eBay or someplace like that. The browser will automatically go out and get the public key of that particular site and then log on, and then they'll negotiate secret keys for the duration of that transaction. Okay, and the point here is that one key is public and is published, and then the other key, the secret key, is known only to the owner. And once you've encrypted with the public key, the only key that can decrypt it is the secret one. Okay, and that's the idea behind the public key process. Okay, so let's go to slide 13, and we have the notion of clear and secure keys. A clear key is a key that when the data is being encrypted inside either a Z series or any other computer, the key itself is unprotected and it is visibly exposed in some manner during the encryption process. An example, system memory. Now, typically, an encryption process is a very, very, very short time period, and so it wouldn't normally be an issue in a system like the Z series, which is so protected by other security mechanisms that it would be very, very difficult for somebody to look in the memory if they knew where to look to find that clear key. On the other hand, some of the distributed processors might have a more open exposure in terms of if somebody's doing an encryption process, another program or another person might be able to get in there if they knew how, and compromise the system by getting a hold of that clear key. Again, the Z-series is pretty locked pretty tight. It would be difficult. Distributed processors might be easier. Now, a secure key is one where the key value that is being used for encryption must have its value protected from view during the encryption-decryption process. This means that even though the encryption process is going on, that nobody can see the key that's being used to do that encryption process. It's a much, much more secure environment. Typically, a master key is used to take a secure key, which is the user key, decipher it, and then perform the encryption-decryption function, and then throw the secure key away. It's typically done in some sort of tamper-resistant device, which is not accessible by the main computer, not accessible by anybody at all. And when you remove, if you were trying to remove this tamper-resistant device, it would self-destruct. Okay. So this is used for the absolutely most secure requirements that a company might have, where if their data was somehow compromised, it would be a disaster. For example, the government or banks or something like that. Okay, now we'll go on to slide 14 and summarize. The most important thing about keys, and I alluded to that before, is key management. All right, key management, if you don't do a good job at key management, then you cannot ensure the integrity of the encrypted data. So key management means a couple of things. One, it means you have to protect the keys from accessibility by people who are not authorized or programs that are not authorized to look at those keys. And we have a product you're going to hear about later, integrated cryptographic support facility, which is integrated into ZOS. It's part of the operating system. It has a very, very powerful key management tool. In addition to protecting the keys from somebody trying to access it when they shouldn't, there's the notion of down the road, 4, 5, 6 years from now, you've got all this encrypted data stored off-site, and maybe the government or some other organization or your own organization needs to look at that data, and you bring all this data back, you have to be able to match up the keys that were used to encrypt that data so that you can now decrypt it and look at it. And these are keys that might have long gone out of use, because typically when you use keys, you change them from time to time. Sometimes you change them every time you do an encryption, you use a new key. So there has to be a mechanism for doing the key management that's going to allow you down the road to be able to match up what data was encrypted by what secure or clear key or whatever kind that it was done. And the integrated cryptographic support facility is the IBM ZOS facility that's going to allow you to do that. Now, a public key, again, is published and accessible to all, but a secret key is known only to the owner and whoever the owner authorizes to see that secret key. And again, when you do public key encryption, it consists of both a public key and a secret key. Slide 15. So the concepts of keys continued is that a clear key is an unenciphered key that is visible during an encryption and decryption process. A secure key is an enciphered key that is not visible during that process. A master key is required in order to use secure keys, and that master key is stored within a secure, tamper-resistant device where the encryption-decryption process occurs. You also use the master key if you want to encrypt any user key that might not be a clear key. For example, you might have clear keys that you're using to encrypt and decrypt the data, but when you store that key in a repository, you want to encipher it. You want to encrypt it so that nobody can look at that. You would still use the tamper-resistant device to do that. The tamper-resistant device would receive the key that's going to be stored in the repository, encipher it, okay, send it back, and then ICSF would store that key into the repository. So there's another reason why down the road you have to be able to match up the user keys that are more likely enciphered and the master key that was used to encipher that key. So you've got a couple of layers of keys that you're going to have to manage over time. Okay. In many ways, the process of managing keys is more difficult than the actual encryption process itself. Okay, slide 16. Okay, and here's the slide about the integrated cryptographic service facility. Again, it's integrated in the ZOS operating system, and in most cases, it's responsible for supporting all of the hardware data encryption. At the very least, it's responsible for managing the keys. All right, at the very least. And that's the first item, an enhanced key management. And it's the keys are stored in a data set called the cryptographic key data set. It also supports key creation and distribution, public keys, secret keys, secure, clear keys, master keys, and a tamper-resistant device. And it has key recovery capabilities. In addition to that, we don't want anybody to have the ability to actually go into that data set and read the keys themselves or to have to know what a key is to get it. So each key is actually assigned a key label or a key alias, and this is the index of the cryptographic key data set. And this key label can be RACF, well, I'd say RACF, but actually through the the ZOS Security Access Facility, you can protect this key label from unauthorized use. So any security product like IBM's RACF that exploits the Security Access Facility can protect these key labels from unauthorized use. And so IBM or IMS or DB2, the only thing it knows about is this key label. And if it's not authorized to use that key label, there is no way that it can go get the key. We also have some digital certificate support in ICSF. And here we are on slide 17. I'm going to talk a little bit more about access control. The key is the key labels. I wanted to repeat this because it's very, very important. Everybody understand that in the key management process, we have to securely protect those keys. It's the ZOS Security Access Facility along with ICSF that allows you to do that. Now, within ICSF itself, there is a software API interface to get at the cryptographic hardware. And this API interface is acceptable from application programs. It's acceptable from middleware like IMS, CICS, and any of the other middleware subsystems that IBM and potentially non-IBM products that are out there. And also, if you have a need, you can develop your own installation-defined callable services, which may actually change the way the tamper-resistant device encrypts and decrypts data, how it handles keys, and things like that. So it's possible if the tamper-resistant device doesn't meet your particular needs, that you can write your own, and IBM has a special team that helps you do that to ensure that when you get done, you have a totally secure environment. On slide 18, I'm going to turn this over to Ernie. Did I get that right, Ernie?
Yeah, that's great, James. Thank you very much. And good morning to everyone and I guess maybe for the folks in Europe, good afternoon. We appreciate you taking the time with us today. So the next section of the presentation, we're going to talk at least in general, and then a little further, we'll talk into some more detail about a couple of specific offerings that IBM has to help you manage the encryption of your DB2 and IMS data. The first product is the data encryption tool for DB2 and IMS databases. Just some high-level information. The implementation of this tool is very easy, very straightforward. The tool provides an ISPF-driven dialogue that will help you build customized exits based in part on your choice of the encryption type, whether you want to use secure or clear key encryption. The use of this tool requires no application changes. However, and we'll talk to a little more detail later in the presentation, this could imply some administration considerations for the DB2 customer, for example, based on some restrictions raised by the use of EditProc, and we'll talk about that later. There are no version dependencies, so all supported releases of IMS and DB2 can use the encryption tool. However, based on the hardware and the ICSF support that's available in your particular hardware configuration, it might drive you to make some decisions, for example, in the area of the choice between clear and secure key. What we'll do is in the invocation of the tool, we actually generate pre-coded exits for the IMS customer. These would be the IMS segment edit compression exit for the DB2 customer. These would be DB2 edit proc exits. Like I said earlier, the choice of whether you generate secure or clear key determines what type of exit. SecureKey is going to use the ICSF API. The ClearKey, again, depending upon the hardware you're running, could use the operating system instruction set available with CPACF if it's indeed enabled for your hardware. So this was slide 18. We'll proceed to the next slide. And just a little more information about the tool. We have the ICSF administrator, who may also be the administrator of the tool, makes a choice as to how the key label is generated. The key label is then provided to the tool in the ISPF dialog. The key label is then generated into the exit. Today we support DES. We do have a statement of direction that a future release of the data encryption tool may support AES 128-bit encryption, again, if I'm running on the appropriate Z hardware. Pay attention to any announcements that may be coming up in the near future. Santa Claus may have an announcement in his bag for the DB2 and IMS customer. That's assuming that you are good. Otherwise, he might be just bringing you a lump of coal. So more to come on this, possibly. Now we're going to go to the next slide. So we're going to talk mainly about solutions that are focused on database IMS and DB2. But we do want to talk for a few minutes about a companion product that offers a complementary set of functionality for encryption to some non-relational data sources. One example where this might be of interest to a DB2 customer, let's say I have a requirement where I unload data from a DB2 table that's then shipped to a business partner. An example of this could be maybe a bank or a credit card clearinghouse company that transmits or shares credit information with a credit bureau. So there certainly would be a requirement that as that data is unloaded, the data that even if it is encrypted by the tool, the utility will, of course, unencrypt it because it drives the edit proc. So I may need to securely share that data, have the ability to then encrypt that extract file as it's transmitted to my business partner. So what we've had is a set of announcements, part of which are now generally available, part of which will be generally available December the 2nd for a facility called the IBM Encryption Facility for ZOS version 1.1. And unfortunately, I didn't include this on the presentation, but that product number is 5655-P97. It is an MSU or an MLC-based feature code of ZOS. Consists of two orderable features, the first of which is referred to as the encryption services feature that became generally available October the 28th. The second component of the facility is called the DFSMS encryption, and that service is at least in plan to be generally available December the 2nd. Again, because it's not GA yet, these plans are subject to change. You can look at the software announcement 205-243, dated September 27th, for some more information about the announcement dates. So with the encryption facility, we provide those two features, as well as a third feature, which was also generally available October 28th, via download from the Internet to provide some facility to allow partners to share and exchange secure key information where the source provider of the data may be a ZOS customer that has the encryption facility. The target partner may have ZOS, but may not have the encryption facility enablement on their ZOS platform, or may even be a non-Z partner. And this facility is called the Encryption Facility Client, and provides a mechanism for secure key exchange, either with PKE or password exchange being supported. Now, all of this requires the ZOS operating system of ZOS 1.4 or higher. A little more information about the encryption facility. It can be invoked via JCL. You can choose to generate either TDES or AES 128-bit encryption, again, depending on hardware. One of the nice things about this facility is it uses hardware compression first and then encrypts the data after the compression has been performed. If you are interested in using the encryption facility client, this can then be used to exchange either public key or private keys or passwords to allow you to securely exchange the data with your sharing partner, or provide your sharing partner, regardless of platform, as long as they have a platform that does support Java, to allow them to decrypt the data that you've securely transferred to them via file sharing. Okay, the next, just a couple more information, pieces of information about the encryption facility. It does support physical sequential files. It currently does not have support for VSAM or no PDSs. However, for example, with VSAM, you could conceivably copy the VSAM file using repro to create a physical sequential format and then compress that prior to sharing. And there also is no national language support at this time. So the other feature that, again, not GA yet, so a little less information available to date, but we expect this to GA in early December, is the archival encryption using DFDSS and the encryption facility feature for encryption of DFDSS. So the way this is going to work is there will be a couple of ways to invoke this encryption. One is going to be there will be additional keywords available on the dump and restore command. There will be some extensions into DFHSM for the HSM customer. And also ISMF, will the panel process will have some facilities in there to invoke the encryption process as well. And again, like the earlier feature that was discussed, compression will occur before encryption. However, there could be, because we're using a hardware encryption, there could be, depending upon your data, you could notice some increase in the size of the resulting encrypted data because the compression process may not be as efficient as you're currently seeing. So we should be on slide number 21 now. With version 8 of DB2, we also introduced data encryption support via built-in functions. We extended the SQL language to provide this built-in function support. It's a standard feature of DB2 UDB version 8 on ZOS. It does require you to be in new function mode in order to enable this this feature. It addresses open standards, and by that, what we're doing is we're providing family compatibility for greater synergy across the UDB family. The real intention behind this was to satisfy some of the open standards requirements across other relational database managers to aid customers that may choose to migrate from one of those other disparate DBMS platforms to DB2 on Z. It's implemented via extensions to the SQL. So because of this, it's going to require application program changes. Not only is it going to require application changes to invoke the built-in functions, but it will also require object schema changes because the column characteristics and the definitions in the object schema need to be changed not only to support the storing of some password information, but also to change the data characteristics to 4-bit data. And then There is going to be some additional considerations. We'll talk about those right now. There are some utility, both IBM and third-party utility considerations that need to be taken into account. We encrypt both the index and the data. So because of the index encryption, we could experience some access path changes, which you need to be aware of. And some data types that are encrypted will require SQL casting. Again, this is going to imply some additional application change in order to support those data types. So we should be on the next slide now. This slide talks about the data encryption flow from a DB2 perspective. And this slide kind of gives you an overview of an entire ZOS environment. With all of the subsystems and the applications that could be in or around DB2, one note up on the upper right-hand side, we list a number of different hardware environments. However, down on the hardware layer, notice that we have CPACF and the Crypto Express 2 coprocessor. This support is only available for a customer running a Z890, a Z990, or a Z9 processor. I just wanted to point that out. And the DB2 and the ICSF parts are highlighted because this is what we're focusing on here. But we want to make sure that you understand that encryption is a lot bigger picture and a lot bigger issue than just a DB2. And there is operating system support with ICSF to help you manage your entire environment. We're also going to see here that that we have on the left-hand side, it's kind of an indication of the options that when I'm implementing the tool that I have in interacting with ICSF. So on the far left-hand side, you see the black arrow running from the DB2 clear key block down to the CPACF. And that implies that when I implement a clear key version of the tool, I'm able to generate an exit that will not interact with the API. Instead, it actually invokes the hardware instructions directly. So clear key, by inference, because there's less code path that has to be traversed, is going to perform much better. However, because I'm doing the clear key encryption and decryption process in the clear, and James described that a little earlier in the presentation, I would be potentially operating in an environment where that storage is available for view, so it could provide me with some potential compromise. So your choice of clear key or secure key is going to be driven by your own unique security requirements. And then we also see that I can implement, at least for the DB2 exit, a clear key implementation that would use the API, and this would be a situation where I would be running on a processor that was not CPACF enabled. And then as we move to the right, we see the representation of the secure key processing, and we see a description of, for example, the retrieval and deciphering of the data and the keys occur within the tamper-resistant device. So again, much more secure. The operating system storage is not available for view, so your key and your key label information cannot be seen. However, because I'm going through more layers, there is additional path link, so I would expect a reduction in performance.
Ernie, just one point. This is Jeff. When you're doing the DB2 clear key, the encryption process itself goes directly to CPACF, but it still has to retrieve the key from the repository over to the right, the CKDS. That's why that one black arrow is there. So that's just one retrieving the key in the beginning, but you retrieve it just once.
And thank you for pointing that out. And again, this, and you're going to hear this over and over again, is that this is kind of a catchphrase, but encryption is easy. Key management, secure key management is hard. And that's where IBM has made a significant investment in ICSF. We'll continue to leverage the ICSF, and that, quite frankly, is the strength of our solutions. We provide secure, tamper-resistant, consistent key management. So going to the next slide, And this speaks to IMS versus DB2. And I'm going to defer to my partner on the call to let him describe briefly the IMS encryption flow, if you don't mind, James.
No, that's no problem. I do have one question. I just noticed that my slide is a little bit corrupted here. Is yours? I don't see the whole thing. I don't know why. Let me switch over to my other copy of this quickly. Here it is. Okay. First, I'd like to ask, does everybody see the complete picture that shows an IMS clear key on the left and an IMS secure key on the right? Does everybody see that with black arrows and blue arrows, that sort of thing? Is that visible, Ernie?
I can see that. Okay. I'm going to speak for everybody else on the call, and that's a yes.
Oh, okay. I think something happened with my my version of it, so I apologize for that. Okay, so there are some differences between IMS and DB2. One of those is the current version of the IBM data encryption for IMS and DB2 tool doesn't have direct support for CPACF when you're doing clear key processing. In this case, it's always going through ICSF to do first to retrieve the key, and after it retrieves the key, it uses ICSF APIs to request that ICSF drive the hardware to do clear key encryption. And if it's on a Z890, Z990, I have to correct these foils, it has the CPACF feature to do that. Okay? Hopefully in a announcement to come, you'll see that IMS will also support the kind of direct CPACF invocation for clear key processing. On the right, with the IMS secure key encryption decryption exit, it has to go through ICSF. And that's because all the encryption and decryption is going to be done in the tamper-resistant device. And the tamper-resistant device is only accessible via ICSF, which is a ZOS key zero implementation, this provides another level of both hardware and software security. Okay, so that's the only message in the difference between IMS and DB2 for this particular tool. In every other aspect, it's the same as DB2. So back to you, Ernie.
Thanks, James. So we're going to go to the next slide. We're going to talk for a minute about, and this is more of a functional or a hardware evolution that we think illustrates IBM's commitment to cryptography. We've shown a consistent improvement in available hardware features. The most current or most recent was the hardware support that was added for AES and SHA-256 in the Z9 processors. We've also, in terms of, we see an evolution in functionality. We also, at the same time, we've delivered performance improvements, and you can see it called out in the arrows as we've moved from the time frame, the 1999 time frame, where we had the PCI CC and the crypto CCF facility. As we move into the Crypto Express 2 and the CPACF arena, you can see that we've, in some cases, dramatically improved the performance of cryptographic services with the use of ICSF facilities. But history takes us a lot further than this. So although this slide shows us starting in 1999, we actually started much, much earlier. IBM has been in the hardware cryptography game since 1970. We also have a legacy of very robust enterprise security support in things like RACF to control access to resources and applications, which was developed and delivered in 1976. And then ICSF, the early versions of ICSF for key management, was actually delivered as built into the operating system in 1991. And about that same time, we saw Tivoli provide some security applications. Tivoli Access Manager, for example, came in about that same time. Intrusion Detection Services delivered in 2001. PKI to allow a ZOS server to create digital certificates and to act as a certificate authority was introduced in 2002. We saw in 2004, and actually we see an exploitation of this in DB2 version 8, we introduced multi-level security, and then in 2005 we continued the evolution with the encryption facility for ZOS. The next slide talks a little bit more about this, and the intent behind this is to basically contrast the different hardware features and how they may apply to the corresponding processor type. So this more or less reads from the bottom up in chronological or evolutionary sequence. For encryption support, the current flavors are Clear Key, CPACF, and the Crypto 2 Express for secure key support. These two flavors are available on Z890 and Z990, as well as Z9, which is the current Z hardware of choice. AES and SHA-256 currently require the Z9 and currently are not supported in the tool. We hope that some future release will rectify this. Just one point about the product matrix that I know some of the customers on the call may be located in geographies outside the continental United States. Some of this cryptography technology is subject to export restrictions. So you need to consult with your local IBM Z-Series hardware contacts to determine what hardware configuration in terms of cryptographic support is currently available to you. So we should be on the next slide, and now I want to just very briefly go through the summary. The key message here is that we've demonstrated a long history of cryptographic hardware support. We continue the evolution in this support. ICSF is a strategic direction with IBM, and remember the comment I made a few minutes ago that encryption is easy. Key management is what's very difficult. And so why is key management and ZOS centralized key management important to you? Well, for one thing, we've demonstrated with over a decade of production use that we've got a real good implementation. It's robust, it's scalable, and it is secure. It helps you manage and protect your keys. It supports a variety of encryption standards, allows for the easy and consistent generation of keys, allows you to do key management based upon your customer policies, and it also provides the ability to do key recovery, not only from the local site, but also to assist you in the population and recovery of keys in a disaster, which is particularly important. We all are now living in an age of increased emphasis on regulatory compliance, governmental regulations as well as state regulations. Industry regulations are driving us to look at processes and data a little differently. So by having this consistent key management approach, we also provide you the ability to provide some compliance in the area of auditability. We can demonstrate strict and secure management controls over the keys, as well as the access controls, as James mentioned earlier. For example, RACF can secure which requester can access and use a certain a key label. So we provide a very granular level of access control. And we provide a clear integration with other ZOS security features. So we think we've got a very good story to tell with the combination of ICSF, the Z-Series hardware platform, and tools like the IMS and DB2 encryption tool and the encryption facility for ZOS. And we think they complement each other very well. However, we do understand that there's more work that needs to be done in this arena. So on the next slide, we want to talk just for a second about some future direction. And remember, this is a direction, not an announcement. So the statements that we're talking about to this slide represent some plans, but not necessarily an intent, which can be changed without notice. So I think I've probably made the lawyers happy. So having said that, our statement of direction is going to be that in some future technology, we're going to support encryption capabilities within the storage environments so that the middle layer or the application servers may not necessarily be aware of the encryption being performed. And this would be for both the total storage tape and disk environments. However, notice on the left-hand side, and this again, the key here is that we will continue to leverage ICSF for key management. And so from an enterprise-wide perspective, implementing various encryption technologies today, because we're relying on ICSF for the secure key management, you're insured of being able to leverage the investment that you make today, regardless of the future direction that we see down the road with this statement of direction. The other interesting thing, or the nice thing about this, is that we do have a roadmap. We do have a plan. We're working towards this. Expect to see more details as we move forward in time on this initiative. If you're interested, this statement of direction was actually published in a hardware announcement, and that announcement number is 105-241, and that was July 27th of this year. So on the next slide, to kind of conclude, there are some nice publications out there that can provide you with some additional levels of information. The first three called out in this slide are good information for the DB2 and IMS encryption tool. The next two discuss the version 8 built-in function implementation. There's also a performance red book that was published last year on version 8. There's a section in there that discusses the built-in function implementation and some of the performance implications revolving around that. And then the bottom part of the presentation provides some ICSF documentation literature as well. Again, thank you for talking with us, allowing us to talk with you today about this topic. We hope that we've provided you with some valuable information. And Amber, I think we're now ready for questions, so could you please open the line for questions now?
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically today. To ask a question, simply press your star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. Once again, that's star 1. We'll first hear from Ernest Nachtigall.
Hello. I just have a couple of comments. just so we don't annoy the Belgian cryptographers who developed AES, it's not the American encryption standard. It is the advanced encryption standard. Also on panels 12 and 14, you talk about public and secret key. The terminology really that people use today is public and private, not secret. Secret is usually reserved for the symmetric key like DES and AES. Also, on the PDF, the IMS panel 23, there is really no right side to on the right-hand side of that panel, the secure key stuff is missing in the PDF. I guess it just didn't show up in the formatting there.
We just discovered that the PDF file that got put out there got a little bit corrupted.
Yeah.
We're not sure why, and I'm going to create a new one, and we'll put it out there this afternoon.
Okay. And also on panel 16, it talks about ICSF has APIs for certificate support. That's really stretching it because there is no real certificate support in ICSF.
That is correct. It's minimal, but there is some there.
Well, all that's there is encrypt decrypt, but nothing really
certificate
based. So it's really, really, really stretching it. Okay, that's all I had.
Yeah. For the customers on the call, Ernie is one of the developers of ICSF and is one of the acknowledged encryption experts in the ZOS community here at IBM. And I appreciate, Ernie, you listening on the call and providing us those corrections.
I also
appreciate
wrote the first version of the encryption facility.
Oh, that's great.
So thank you very much.
And once again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1. We'll hear from Mike Fatula.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hey, I haven't been able to view the slides you were talking about. Would you be able to email me that site? And has this been recorded so I can listen to it again?
Diane, would you like to address that?
Yes, I sure would. Mike, if you would send me, I think, in the information, my email is there. dmccallu@us.ibm.com. Please send me an email. You should have received notification, but if not, we'll resend it to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And then there is a replay this afternoon. You can listen this afternoon if you'd like or in the future.
Okay,
and we'll put a corrected PDF file up before this afternoon's.
It probably won't get out before this afternoon.
It won't?
No.
Too bad.
Longer, but we will have it out for the near future.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, now hear from Richard F. April.
Hi. By the way, very very nice presentation, very clearly stated. I have a question about, I guess best would be slide 15. Having seen several of these presentations, it's finally beginning to sink in the differences between clear key and secure key, et cetera. But I want to make sure I understand something here. Your definition there where you say clear key is unenciphered, I assume to me that it's basically the key that's being used is in memory and visible if somebody were able to look at memory. Number two, then you say secure key is enciphered and not visible. Again, I'm assuming that just means that the key is encrypted. What I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding is if you have this encrypted secure key, and you say on the third bullet that the master key is used to encipher and decipher all secure keys. Is this secure key stored somewhere? Where did this key come from? And if, in fact, you're using the master key to encipher and decipher it, I guess my question would be, why would you not just use the master key instead of the secure key?
That's a good question. This is Jim. If you skip forward to slide 22, the
22?
Uncorrupted version of this picture.
Okay.
You'll notice where it says DB2 secure key encryption decryption. Okay. The first thing that the tool has to do is to get the key.
Okay.
Right? And so it has to know the key label. And normally the process is that the key it presents to ICSF the key label. Which is that then security protected, okay, through some security access facility like RACF,
okay,
to make sure that this IMS is authorized to look at that key label. All right, if it is, it goes out to the CKDS, that's the repository, the cryptographic key data set, and using the key label is the index that reads in the enciphered user key.
Okay.
Okay, and then the enciphered user key and the data to be encrypted is sent to the tamper-resistant device, which is at the bottom right in this example. It's the newest one we have. And inside the tamper-resistant device, okay, the enciphered user key is then deciphered by the master key. And now it's a clear key inside that tamper-resistant device.
Okay.
And once it's a clear key inside the tamper-resistant device, it can be used to encrypt or decrypt the data.
Okay, I that was very clear. Then I guess the only remaining question would be, why would you use an individual secure key that's being put in this tamper-resistant device as opposed to just using the master key for the encryption and decryption?
That's an easy one. It's because every application might not have, okay, the same levels of security. It might not have. For example, you can use the tamper-resistant device to store clear keys in the repository in an enciphered way, so that nobody can get the repository and decipher a key that's eventually going to be used in clear key processing with the hardware device on the left.
Okay.
Okay. So each application may have different levels of security requirements.
Gotcha.
An example of that might be, in the case of a customer I visited yesterday, they have a large IMS system where they keep a Visa number as the key of a root segment. All right? And associated with that Visa number is some data in the same segment. The cardholder's name, the expiration date, and the four-digit code. Now, this is very, very, very important data that you might use the tamper-resistant device to encrypt and decrypt, so that you never have an opportunity to have any key exposed. On the other hand, the child segment may just contain some sales information that doesn't identify who the card is or anything like that. And that information, you want to encrypt it, but isn't as important. So in that case, okay, you might want to use a different key, key, to use a cheaper mechanism for doing the encryption and decryption. And then, of course, you have the situation where you got multiple IMSs and multiple CICSs, and you don't want everybody using the same key.
Sure. One last one, and I'll let somebody else get a word edgewise in here. If you're using this technique, everything seems to be being done in the tamper-resistant device, so the CEX Crypto Express 2 hardware facility. I've also been hearing that there is still regular processor overhead while this encryption is being done. Does this chart point out where and what is being done on the general purpose processors versus what is being done in the actual card, the Crypto Express card?
Well, what happens is when you got some data you want to encrypt, like a DB2 row or an IMS segment, all the stuff gets passed to the gets queued up to the tamper-resistant device.
Right.
Okay. It's actually like a message queuing thing. Okay. So the encryption tamper-resistant device might have n number of different programs passing its stuff to be encrypted or decrypted. While it's queued up and being encrypted or decrypted by this tamper-resistant device, the processor that initiated it is free to go on and do whatever it wants. Okay? And when the tamper-resistant device is done, it can interrupt any other processor to take the data back again. Okay? So while there's a little bit of overhead involved in taking the data and queuing it up in the tamper-resistant device, no, the actual central processor it does not have to wait. Okay, it can go on and be dispatched in other work. Now, on the left side of the picture, slide 22, the CPACF, which is this is the central processor doing the encryption.
Okay.
Okay. In this case, the reason you don't have to use ICSF is because it can be invoked through problem state, okay, programs, key of 8,
mm-hmm.
okay, whereas the tamper-resistant device, for obvious reasons, can only be invoked by key 0 program,
okay.
which is the ICSF.
Okay.
Okay. So it all depends upon your business requirements, how much you feel it's going that your risk is, And then from that you determine, which data needs to have which level of security, and then that drives you down to the different combinations of way that you can do the hardware encryption.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, one other additional comment I'd like to throw in here is that in from the performance perspective, depending on your hardware, you're going to see different characteristics. So, for example, if I'm a Z800 or Z900 customer, I'm going to have a little different story than if I was a Z990 or a Z9. So the idea is as I move upward in the hierarchy in terms of newer hardware, newer operating system, the performance penalty becomes lower.
I understand that, and the reason I asked the question was because of the product that's coming out for archiving, and there was some indication that there are definite performance implications of depending upon how many volumes you happen to be encrypting concurrently. And they talked about the overhead within the card as well as the overhead within the central processors.
Right.
Okay.
Well, again, though, that relates back to which processor you're using. And also, you know, typically when you do DDRs or dumps or whatever you call it, you're compressing the data to do first.
Correct.
Okay, and that's all hardware.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a lot of factors involved in that.
Got it. Thank you.
And we'll now hear from Mike Goddard.
You've already pretty much been talking about what I was going to ask about was the overhead involved with cryptographics.
And just to note, I referenced the version 8 performance redbook for DB2. If you're interested in the performance metrics for the DB2 flavor of the tool, as well as the built-in function, there's some good performance metrics that have been documented in there. I'll say the caveat that your data and your workload is certainly going to be different, but you can get an indication. My understanding also is that for the ZOS encryption facility, there is some benchmarking that is being done as we speak, and that there is a statement that at some point in time, probably after the DFDSS component of the facility is GA'd, expect to see some performance publications about that solution as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think, again, it's very important to understand that this is highly dependent upon your business requirements and to what level you decide you have to do encryption, okay? And it also depends upon a very, very clear understanding of how your databases are organized. For example, in IMS, you have hierarchical databases that when you introduce encryption, you might want to go in and change a little bit some of the parameters in terms of the way the data is stored to reduce the number of segments that have to be encrypted and decrypted. And I'm sure that there are some similar types of things that you might want to look at from a DB2 point of view. But in any case, it doesn't impact the application programs.
And we'll now hear from Harry Petit.
Hi. You've talked about some of this. Could you talk a little bit more about the various kinds of encryption algorithms, like DES, TripleDES, RSA, SHA, whatever, and what impact, well, I guess, how you decide which one to use and what impact that would have on the performance, overall performance of using the method you've chosen?
Ernie, let me kind of address that and say that the decision as to which algorithms to use is probably a little bit beyond the scope of this presentation. That would probably be handled within your security department, okay, and they would make that decision. But the general rule of thumb is the more security you want, the more modern algorithm you want. And I apologize for saying American encryption standard. I knew that it wasn't that. It's just, I guess it was a slip of the tongue. So, for example, AES, we support 128-bit key encryption on the Z9. And in time, one would expect that you would see 256-bit encryption. The choice, again, it depends on what is the application, okay, what are your business requirements, what are your security requirements, and what is it going to cost you to implement the various choices. So, for example, if you wanted to use clear key processing for CPACF to get at the AES 128-bit encryption, then you would have to go to a Z9. And that might be a good thing or a bad thing for you. Okay, so your security requirements might drive you in one direction, and the cost might push back in another direction. Okay, so the choice of which one of these algorithms to pick has a lot of different factors going in it. But my guess is the security department would decide that based on their understanding of the security levels required for this specific environment. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I was just trying to get an overview of the hierarchy of going from less secure to more secure.
Yeah.
And, of course, if the security department decides that they want to use a SHA-256, is that going to drive my performance analyst nuts?
Yeah, you might drive the people who, because it's only supported on the Z9 here, in hardware.
Yep.
Okay. Most everything can be done in software, but you wouldn't want to do that.
Right.
Okay. And, again, if you wanted to use SHA-256 and AES, then you have to use clear key processing because the Crypto Express coprocessor tamper-resistant device doesn't support that yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
One other comment, and again, it is a little bit beyond the scope of our area of expertise, but I would imagine, for example, credit card processing customers or providers are being held to a Visa initiative, for example, that spells out a minimum encryption requirement, for example, that needs to be DES 3.
Okay.
So they're probably going to be, you know, regulatory or, other requirements that will drive your security department into making those decisions. One other thing that will probably drive you into that one direction or the other might be, who do you share the data with? So you may elect to implement AES or SHA-256, but if you share data with a partner that may be on a DES 3 standard, you may have to do some handshaking or some additional coexistence. So that may enter into the decision as well.
Okay, understood.
Yep.
Just one addition to that. Yesterday I called on a customer who had exactly that problem with an IMS system. The Visa credit card number is the key of the root segment in the HDAM database. And they are driven to encrypt that key, and they didn't want to do that. And so I asked them the question. I said, well, if you do encrypt the cardholder's name and you encrypt the expiration date and you encrypt the four-digit code that goes along with that card, of what use is the credit card number to anybody? Okay, because you not only need a credit card number, you need all the other three items that go with it in order to effectively use that card. So you can secure things by inference. Okay, because I've encrypted with a secure key the relevant data to that Visa card, maybe I don't have to encrypt the key. And these are the types of decisions you have to look at when you go through your databases and decide, okay, what part of the data do I really need to encrypt to provide the level of security that my business requires?
Okay.
And it seemed clear to them that Visa's real goal is that the credit cards not be compromised. It doesn't mean that you have to encrypt everything to accomplish that goal. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yep, that's me.
And once again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press *1. If you find that your questions have been answered, please press # to remove yourself from our queue. And at this time, we'll now hear from Dwayne Robb.
Yes, just really wanted to tell you I appreciated the presentation. And I have a question about DFSMS. I realize that's not the focus. Could you tell me if ABARS will, in the December release, if ABARS will be included since it does use DFTSS for encryption?
And again, you hit it on the head. This wasn't the primary focus of this presentation. However, if you could send an email to Diane McCollum, I think she gave you the email address earlier, and I'll give her an opportunity to give it again. We'll see if we can get somebody from the ZOS team to answer that question for you. Is that fair enough?
That's fair. Thank you very much.
And we'll now hear from Helen Gwynn.
My question is hardware-related, so you may want to pass me off also. I'm new to encryption. I'm a storage administrator, so I'm concerned about, you know, your forward direction of tape and disk encryption. But I have a hardware background, so I tend to, you know, dwell on things like redundancy. And my question was about the tamper-resistant device. Is this part of the ZOS platform?
Yes, it is. And in the case that you're talking about, when we deliver on the statement of direction, if we do that, okay, and all the encryption is done at the control unit and hard storage device level, you still have the issue of key management.
Right.
Okay, and the tamper-resistant device would still be fundamental to doing key management using the integrated cryptographic control facility and to ensure the integrity of the keys. Okay,
right.
So there would still be a use for some type of tamper-resistant hardware
in time it may not be this one. Okay, if in time when we're when we've moved all the encryption, as we say we're going to do, over to the storage components, then we may have a different type of tamper-resistant device providing that function. But it would definitely be focused on the Z because that's where integrated cryptographic facility is and the key management.
Is the CKDS the tamper-resistant device? I'm looking
No, that's the data set.
That's a data set.
That's the data set. That's where you store your keys.
That's where you store your keys.
Okay.
And that's on regular DASTI.
That's correct. But when you store your keys, you're probably going to want to store them in ciphered.
Right.
Okay. So in case somebody stole the data set, they couldn't read it. And it also, you would, the index to it would be the key label, so that whoever out there is going to write an application, all they have access to is the key label. They have no access to the key itself.
Is
so,
this a fancy VSAN data set?
Actually, we've not been told its format, but VSAN is good, is as good as any.
Will you use certain utilities to back up and maintain?
Oh, sure.
Or will you use IDCAMs?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I'd like to comment, though, that the mechanisms to administer this environment are well documented in the various ICSF
yes.
publications.
Okay.
And also, this is again, this is not new technology. This technology has been around for a number of years.
I know.
So the ability to do
to
things,
it.
I understand. But the ability to do things like to support backup and recovery and disaster recovery and all of that is very well proven, and in my opinion, that's one of the strengths of not only what we're doing today, but hopefully what we'll deliver in the future, is that because it's built and architected this way, you know, you're going to continue to protect your investment. And quite frankly, you know, this is good for the Z-Series community because, again, it just reinforces the what we all know in the Z community, is that the Z platform is by far and away the most secure, the most robust, the most tamper resistant environment to serve as a data server.
Mm, definitely, I agree. I was concerned about disaster recovery, but I can go read the books. You know, and whether, if you're on a special machine, you know, will the disaster recovery facility have to have that same machine when you're at DR?
There will be some symmetry that needs to be there, not necessarily the exact same configuration.
Uh-huh.
But you know, something, you know, and again, this is a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I would suspect, for example, that you might want to have, if I'm on a Z990, I may want to have a similar class of processor setting at DR.
Right.
But again, there are specific facilities within ICSF to allow you to export the keys and import them in at DR, and there's a whole series of facilities that are built in to allow you to configure and to control that in a disaster.
And did you say one of the books that's in the publications tells you how ICSF is delivered with COS?
Yes.
Okay.
And we'll now hear from William Reno.
Hi, I got just want to make sure I've got this clear. These standards and algorithms that you have specified here are for the ICSF. Now, are we to assume that DB2 supports all of these as well?
DB2 and IMS, you can assume that everything above the level of ICSF that goes through the ICSF API supports all the hardware and all the algorithms that ICSF supports.
Okay.
And you can look in the manuals and read that in excruciating detail if you want to.
Well, I've looked at the manuals, actually. I didn't see anything that specifically said that DB2, for example, would use SHA-256.
Oh, it won't.
Oh, no, it won't.
No, it won't say that. All it will say is that, for example, with the Z9, We support CPACF doing SSA 256. Now it's up to the application to use the ICSF APIs
to invoke that.
So, and in fact, the security person can make it so that the application doesn't know or doesn't care. And that's what the case is with the IMS and DB2, except when it goes directly to CPACF. When it goes through ICSF, it's pretty much transparent. And now the security people can control which algorithms are used based on what hardware they have.
Okay, so if we were to write an ADAPROC or something like that, then we could control it. But in the case of your built-in functions, what standard is used?
Yeah, that was the point I was getting ready to make, was that, you know, you need to distinguish between the use of the encryption tool or the built-in function with version 8. And the built-in function with version 8 is DES 3.
Okay.
Triple DES.
Right. Okay. And so, and there's also some question is, would you ever really want an application other than the ones that are using the problem state instructions to go directly to do clear key processing? Would you really want an application deciding which algorithm to use? You might want the security people to drive that.
Right, but that would be driven, but that's still driven in the ADAPROC, correct? Or what are you saying?
Not necessarily. We'll have to get, if you want to send Diane a question on that, we'll verify that and get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, though, I want to make sure that we understand that that when you talk ADAPROC, that was the implementation that was chosen when we architected the
tool.
The tool doesn't mean to say that you couldn't write your own ADAPROC to then interact with ICSF through the API, for example,
right.
Very complicated programming, and depending upon secure or clear key choice, could be a little dangerous, right? Because you, in one case, you may need to be key zero.
Right.
But when we talk about built-in function, we're not using the ADAPROC. It's an extension to the SQL, and in that case, it's very clear that we're using triple DES.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And we'll now hear from Joe Potato.
Yes, I have some questions regarding DB2, and one, I guess, was just answered about this front-end tool that you use to generate the encryption. Could you do that on a column level? That's, I guess, my first question. Could you use that tool to do column-level encryption?
When the tool was architected, we knew that we were going to be delivering some column-level encryption capability with the version 8 built-in function. And then the second part of that is that as they started looking at the cost of invoking the ICSF, or in the case of ClearKey, the CPACF instruction set, the cost of encrypting a single column versus the cost of encrypting an entire row were relatively equal. So the choice was made to implement via ADAPROC. And encrypt the entire row. I mean, I think at some point in time some thought was given to implementing it field proc, but again, the trade-off was, in terms of performance, was relatively modest, so they went with the edit proc. And so did that answer that question?
Yeah, does this tool actually generate a edit proc that you place into your table?
That is correct.
Okay.
And I think I alluded to in my discussion that we talk about a little more of the details there. So I'll just take a second now to kind of refresh everybody's memory that although the tool, when I do an ADAPROC implementation, I am transparent to the application, so the applications need not change. It does imply that when I implement ADAPROC, there are a few, and I'll use the word loosely, points of baggage that kind of come along with it. So, for example, if I declare an ADAPROC on a table, I can't have any identity, row ID, or lob columns declared on that table. I also, if I've got an ADAPROC, it implies any type of schema change that I subsequently perform on that table. Say I want to add a column. It requires a destructive alteration, so I have to unload all the data and then redefine the schema and then reload the data back. So it's a little more of an administrative burden, which may or may not be deemed acceptable, but in exchange, the applications are completely insulated.
Okay, but now you just mentioned some things that would warrant the fact that you probably want to have some kind of column encryption, like the fact that you couldn't do a lob and you couldn't do an identity column. Is there any thought of column encryption in the future? Or?
Well, again, column encryption is available with through the built-in function in version 8. So if you're interested in just encrypting one column, and that's your primary point of design, and you're running version 8 in new function mode, that is the way that you would probably go. And again, there being just as much baggage from an EDIPROC-based implementation. There are similar but are different but an equal number of points of concern with a column level built-in function implementation. So you need to just kind of like a pain point that you have to analyze in terms of, do I want to do an implementation that isolates the application? Do I want to do something that's column level? And you know, not everybody, every customer will have different, reach different conclusions.
Okay. I have another question is when, because we have EDIPROC, but what I noticed is that when you have compression turned on, is that you kind of lose compression when you use the EDIPROC for encryption. Is that still the case?
And that is another point with the EDIPROC implementation. And actually, this is true on the built-in function with version 8 as well, in that the order in which the data manager drives the EDIPROC versus the compression process. Currently, what's going to happen is the compression is going to occur after the encryption. So, and because the encryption algorithm works quite well, you wouldn't expect to see repeating characters, trailing blanks, that sort of thing, which typically compresses well. So, you would basically, when I'm using encryption for either the column or the row, expect to see little or no benefit with compression. Now, again, the hope is that some future release of DB2, we're going to change the order a data manager drives things, and possibly see some improvement in that arena. And again, the ZOS encryption facility works a little different in that it compresses first and then encrypts the compressed record. So it does a little better job at this point. The other comment I wanted to make about that is that we also have a similar issue if I'm doing log-based replication. In other words, products like Data Propagator or WebSphere Information Integrator, we have an exit basically that sets at the log read IFI exit to snatch the log images for replication. That process as well, there's a timing sequence of when the IFI exit gets driven and whether or not it invokes or drives the EDIPROC. We have plan in progress to fix that for version 8. So if you're a version 8 customer, expect that through the maintenance stream, we're going to fix the order and drive the EDIPROC in the log exit. A version 7 customer, we don't expect to see that relief. Okay?
Okay. And
fair enough.
One last question is, in one of the slides you mentioned that you can encrypt an image copy. Will that be a parameter-driven function on the utility itself?
No, this is a function of the fact that as the data sets on the data page,
okay,
it's already encrypted. So
okay,
the image copies the data page, what CI at a time or page at a time. So it's by virtue of the fact that it's encrypted.
Okay, yeah, because that's why we originally had done encryption. It's just for that. I was just curious if there was a way to get around just doing the image copy, but that's not a feature then.
That's right. And also your log record images are going to be encrypted at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
And we'll now hear from Jeff Deaver.
Hi. Are there any plans for cooperation with third-party vendors such that encryption done with other software products or other hardware such as another vendor's tape drive can have their keys managed in ICSF still?
I don't think I can comment on that. I don't know, James. We need to defer that because, again, that technology is nothing more at this point than a statement of direction. So I have no idea what plans are, whether it's going to be an open API or not.
It's a good question. You can send in to Diane, and we will try to come up with an answer if there's somebody who has made that kind of decision.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll now hear from Ernest Nightingale.
Yeah, just a comment on that last question. If you have a vendor who doesn't have an encrypting tape drive, the ideal solution then is to use the encryption facility to encrypt your tape, and they can then also install the encryption facility and recover it. You don't have to have the same hardware in place. Also, for those of you who are interested and are not aware, there's a TechDoc site, ibm.com/support/TechDocs, T-E-C-H-D-O-C-S, as in shortcut for technical documents. And if you do a search on crypto, you'll get over 50 documents which discuss the crypto facilities, some sizing, some white papers, good to have information, crypto 101, all sorts of good stuff. So just as a general comment, if you do want additional information, check that out.
Now, Ernie, would you send me that website, and I'll add it to the publications list?
Yeah, it's just www.ibm.com/support/TechDoc.
T-E-C-H-D-O-C.
D-O-C-S.
D-O-C-S. Okay, I'll make sure that's right, and I'll add it to the publication.
Yeah, and just search on crypto.
Right.
And there are no further questions. Ms. McCollum, I'll turn the conference back over to you for any closing or additional remarks, ma'am.
Thank you, everybody, for taking time out of your busy schedules to attend. The world is not always secure. How is your data? Obviously, we had lots of great questions, so I'm glad that you stayed with us and got answers to your questions. If you did not, and you'd like further clarification, please send me a message at dmccallu@us.ibm.com, and I will be glad to put you in touch with somebody that can help you. Also, keep in mind that there will be an updated presentation put out on the website. It will not occur instantaneously, but probably within the next several days. So if you'd like an updated presentation, please feel free to go back to the website and get it. Again, thank you for attending. Bye-bye.
And that concludes today's conference. We do appreciate your participation. Have a great afternoon.